Welcome to a new edition of Dark Matters Radio. My name is Don Ecker. I am your host, and you have tuned into the Patriot Brigade Radio Network. Well, tonight's program is genuinely a dark matter. Before we go to our guest, I've got to bring you up to date on what the topic is and how I got here. And this is genuinely a show that has been years in the making. Years, going back to 1981, 1982, when I was a criminal investigator, a detective. And it was the end of October, which in hindsight seems very appropriate. A case crossed my desk, an agricultural crime that involved a dead cow. As it turned out, it wasn't just one dead cow. It ended up being two cows. Okay, fair enough. I went out to the crime scene. It was on a ranch, and the cow was approximately 35 yards from the back of the man's home. Now, I don't know how you would feel if you were a farmer, a rancher, you woke up one morning, looked out back, and one of your animals that had been perfectly healthy the night before was lying there dead, mutilated. But it would be scary. And this particular rancher had suffered this outrage approximately 2 years before. Now, at the time, I was not that aware and familiar with this type of crime. Today, researchers worldwide are familiar with the phenomenon of animal mutilations, primarily cattle, but there have been many other animals that have been mutilated. But one of the strange things about this case was not only was the animal dead, now we're going to get a bit graphic, but this is just to give you an idea. The rectum was poured out of the animal. An eyeball had been removed almost with surgical precision. The flesh on the head of the animal was removed literally to the bone. But the strangest fact was, and this is almost universal today when you're talking about animal mutilations, there were no bodily fluids. The animal had been exsanguinated. As I found out, this rancher had been a victim of a similar crime about a year and a half, approximately 2 years prior. And for almost a year, he was so concerned that he never traveled anywhere without being armed. Nothing else happened, and finally he put his deer rifle away, and then this cropped up. Now, I might add that this particular case was never solved. As a matter of fact, my department, in hindsight, acted rather strangely about this. They wanted the case swept under the rug. But then I was later to find out that this was true with law enforcement agencies practically all over the Western United States. Now, trying to make sense out of this case, I ended up doing a lot of research, and more as intellectual curiosity than anything else, I even began to look at some stranger explanations. Now, it was also about this time that I was talking to somebody in hindsight about this case, and they told me about a very strange story that they had heard that came out of the United Kingdom, out of England, something called the Highgate Vampire case. I had never heard of it. I had no idea what it was. And the information that was relayed to me, and you have to imagine that this was third-hand information at best, I tucked away in the back of my mind and thought, well, you know what, someday I'm going to try to take a look at that and see what might have been real and what wasn't real. Years later, after the World Wide Web really came into its own, one day in the mid to late 1990s, I was on the web and I was doing a little research, and I came across a couple of references to the Highgate case. Later on, after the turn of the century, because of the subject material, I was very interested, very curious, and I was in the process of writing a novel about the supernatural. You may have heard me mention this before, titled Past Sins. I talked to a lot of people, including one recognized worldwide authority by the name of Dr. J. Gordon Melton. Now, Melton is a recognized authority on the vampire mythos, has written a number of books on the subject, and I even spoke to him about this. He references this case in his book titled The Vampire Book, The Encyclopedia of the Undead. And it's on page 333, where he has a several-page inscription on the Highgate vampire case. Now, as I began to do more and more research on it, I found out that there were a number of names associated with this case. The primary investigator at that time was a guy by the name of Sean Manchester. And years later, about 1985 roughly, he had published a book titled The Highgate Vampire by Sean Manchester. Later, he came out with a second edition of this book. And he's written several other books, including The Vampire Hunter's Handbook. Now, I was curious enough to want to get a copy of these books to read them to see what, in fact, might be in there. I couldn't find any copies of The Highgate Vampire here in the United States. I went up to Amazon, I went to some used bookstores. Nobody seemed to have it available. So what I ended up doing was going to Amazon.com UK, United Kingdom. I ordered both these books, and they were delivered to me, and I immediately read them. Now, I gotta tell you, I wasn't quite sure what to make out of this at first. Here was a man who was, by all accounts and all over the web, the primary investigator of this case. Not only did he claim that the vampire was real, but later on that he tracked the vampire from Highgate Cemetery, where he initially performed what he describes as an exorcism, which did not mean impaling the corpse, as most of us who's ever watched a vampire movie knows that that's the way you get rid of a vampire, you stake them. But he performed an exorcism ceremony in the vault, according to what he wrote, and then sealed the tomb using holy accoutrements and garlic. But in the book, he claims approximately a year or so later, the vampire escaped. He later tracked it down to an old falling down mansion not far from the cemetery, with several people in his society. They finally, according to the book, pulled the vampire's coffin out into the daylight. He drove a stake through the chest. The vampire dissolved, and there were some photographs in the book. That wasn't the end of the story. There was also a young lady that he mentioned in the book who garnered the attention of this vampire. The vampire allegedly attacked the young girl. And it was obvious to me, reading between the lines, that at some point in the narrative, that Manchester had had some type of relationship with her. Later, the girl allegedly died. Now, he did not identify her by her correct name. He identified her as Lucia, pseudonym. Now, being a cop, or a former cop, the first thing that came to my mind was, if any of this is true, Let's do a real criminal type investigation. Let's find out who this young lady was, if in fact she died, what was the cause of death on the death certificate, and we'll proceed from there. However, in the book, The Highgate Vampire by Sean Manchester, he claims that later this young woman came back from the dead. Hey, I'm just telling you what was in the book. Came back from the dead and attempted to attack him. He finally exorcised this demon, according to what he wrote, by driving a stake through her. Whereas, and I'm not making this up, the body of this vampire had changed into a giant spider, and it was the spider that he staked. And after disposing of this giant spider vampire, her true form came back, and she was finally achieving the true death. All very Bram Stokerish. Now, you got to admit, this is one hell of a story, especially being touted as being a true story. Now, I've got to bring another name into the mix. Another fellow who was one of the principals of this little drama. A man by the name of David Ferrant. Now, David was also a supernatural investigator at the time. And while Manchester was achieving a lot of notoriety during this period, which was circa 1970, so was Mr. Ferrant. Later on, Mr. Ferrant was arrested by the police for trespassing in a cemetery, desecration of some graves, and so forth. His first case was dismissed. Several years later, he did end up doing a couple of years at the Queen's Pleasure. Now, Mr. Ferrant has always been very forthcoming about this. But somehow, during this period of time, a genuine feud developed between Mr. Manchester and Mr. Ferrant. Now, all I wanted to do was to get to the bottom of this. I have always had a very keen interest in supernatural stories and mythos, mythology, and I've always had a soft place in my heart for a very good vampire story. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that I ended up writing my novel, if I can be so bold. It's something that I would want to read. And that was my intent when I wrote it, as along with having what I thought was a pretty darn good plot banging about in my head. So, several weeks ago, as I am now doing this show, several weeks ago, I was up on Amazon USA. And on Amazon, there is a chat thread there dealing with horror novels. Now, I wanted to go up and, of course, mention my book. And in this horror chat thread, I noticed a new thread that somebody had started called Intelligent Vampire Novels. Hey, well, this was just up my alley. So I joined in, and during the course of a number of message exchanges, I happened to mention my interest in the Highgate Vampire case. And the fact that not long before, I had come across a certain podcast on the net, another podcast that deals with supernatural type things, and looking through a list of their previous shows, I noticed two shows in there that immediately grabbed my interest. One was with Bishop Sean Manchester. Oh yes, now Mr. Manchester is purportedly a man of the cloth. He is a according to his website, a bishop, ordained bishop, in the old Catholic Church in the United Kingdom, not Roman Catholic, the old Catholic Church, and there was a show with Mr. David Ferrant. Now, through all these years that I've had an interest in Highgate, I never was able to find out what the name was of this alleged victim of a vampire attack. Now, I have a very, very good friend, Mr. John Spencer, who is a world-renowned paranormal investigator who lives in the UK. And several years ago, I was in touch with John, and I asked John, would you please find out how I could go about contacting Bishop Manchester? And John finally got back to me, and for whatever reason, he told me that that organization had no interest in speaking with me. Okay, so now I'm on this thread, and after I downloaded those shows and listened to both of them, David Ferrant finally answered the question that I have had for many years, or at least I thought he did. He identified the alleged victim of this vampire attack, called Lucia, in Manchester's book as one Jacqueline Cooper. Upon learning her name, I immediately shot a note to my friend John Spencer and asked him what were the rules and regulations about securing copies of death certificates in the UK, and would he be willing to do a little nosing about to find out where, in fact, this woman is alleged to have been buried at. And on the thread up on Amazon, I made a note, and I said, hey, and along with the Highgate vampire case, a question I've always had as a criminal investigator was this alleged victim. I've never been able to identify her. However, I just heard an internet radio show with Mr. David Ferrant identifying this girl as Jacqueline Cooper. Well, who would have thought that little threads like this were being examined by apparently people in the UK affiliated with Bishop Manchester? Several days later, I get several emails. The first one, out of the blue, telling me that there's been no further vampire infestation in Highgate Cemetery since Bishop Manchester whacked the vampire all those years ago. And then the second note is very angry, directed at me personally, identifying this Lucia character as one Jacqueline Cooper, and they demanded that I remove it or they were going to Amazon. Well, now, this note was unsigned other than by the quote-unquote friends of Bishop Sean Manchester, unquote. So I immediately sent them a note back, and this is exactly what I said. Dear friends of Bishop Sean Manchester, or friends of the